This episode is brought to you by the online workshop, Take Up Space, a workshop on boundaries, self-worth, and strengthening your relationship with self, which is a workshop by me, and it drops June 13th. If you want to grab your spot now, it's entirely online and on demand. You can access it as much and as many times as you want over the course of the year that it's available. And it's all about why your boundaries never have to be justified, about why they don't have to be rational and why they're never up for debate. Plus the complexity of boundaries in relationship to other, which is really ultimately about taking up space and being heard, honored, and respected. And also the ways that we create the things we do want. Our boundaries include our yeses and those places we want to journey to and the places we want to explore. And let's also talk about how it feels when someone else sets a boundary that maybe makes us feel disappointed. That workshop is dropping in a few weeks. So if you want to pre-enroll now, just click the link in the show notes or head to sexgetsreal.com/EP215 for episode 215 and click the link.
You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey, you. Welcome to this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. I am your host, Dawn Sarah, and this week is an episode with Shadeen Francis. Shadeen is a therapist who was part of Explore More Summit. We've known each other for a couple of years. Shadeen does incredible work in the world, and her talk was one of the fan favorites from the summit. So I thought, what better excuse than to talk to her again for the podcast? We go into trust and her formula for trust, which is pretty incredible, especially if you're someone who has experienced betrayal or cheating. We talk all about transparency versus honesty, boundary setting, the importance of having a variety of relationships in your life, including a relationship to yourself. And Shadeen even talks about how part of the erotic relationships that she has includes with her work, which totally resonated with me. So it's a really interesting chat. Shadeen has such wonderful stories to share and loads of practical experience and advice as someone who has been a therapist and worked with so many people in crisis around their relationships and their sexuality. And then for Patreon supporters, if you support at the $3 level or above, you get access to every single week's bonus content, which is usually anywhere from 7 to 20 minutes of all kinds of extra conversations that happen every single week. And of course, your $3 help to keep the lights on here at the show, because finding advertisers for a show that talks about sex and kink who are ethical and have money to spend is increasingly rare. So your financial support actually makes this show possible, like in a really real way. So you can head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal. You have to type in the URL. You can't search for it at Patreon because it's considered adult content. And if you head there, if you support at the $3 level and above, you can hear Shadeen and I. We talk about relationship behaviors that can be super toxic and what to look out for, why often these behaviors are coming from a place of shame. And then we also talk about scorekeeping and how often in relationships, especially relationships that are starting to kind of not go so well, scorekeeping can be a way that we punish and track each other's behavior. Shadeen has this beautiful reframe for how we can actually use scorekeeping to make our relationship even more bonded and more delightful to be in. And of course, we talk about play. So you can either support at $3 to get that access, or if you already support, then head over there to hear it. So let me tell you a little bit about Shadeen, and then we will jump into our conversation. Shadeen Francis is a marriage and family therapist, professor, and author specializing in sex therapy and social justice. Shadeen has been featured on platforms like 6ABC, The New York Times, and The Huffington Post to share her expertise And she also speaks internationally on topics such as sexual self-esteem, intimacy, and inclusivity. Shadeen's belief is that the world is built on the strengths of communities. This worldview has propelled her to focus on underserved populations, ethnic and cultural minorities, the kinky poly queer communities, and victims of economic hardship. Her work allows people of all backgrounds to improve their relationships and live in peace and pleasure. As you can hear, Shadeen is incredibly special and does amazing work in this world. So let's jump in, and here is my chat with Shadeen Francis. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Shadeen. I can't wait to talk to you today.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us and for being here.
Oh, I'm so excited to dig in.
Oh my God, me too. I was obsessed with the conversation that we had for Explore More, and I know so many people in the community were like, minds blown. So I'm really excited to get to bring this to Sex Gets Real as well.
Oh, me too. I loved the conversation that we got to have. And so I'm so glad that people were getting some juicy bits out of it.
So I would love to start, for people who aren't familiar with you, can you just tell them a little bit about how you got here, who you are, the work you do in the world, kind of like your favorite places to dig around in and be a genius.
Well, thank you for that compliment you slipped in there. So I'm a marriage and family therapist. I specialize in sex therapy and social justice stuff. I had sort of an interesting sort of coming of age story into this work. And so those people who have followed me for a little while have maybe heard me tell the longer version of this story, but kind of the short version was that I grew up, really my only professional plan was to join the X-Men. So I was mostly like jumping off of like high things and hoping that some of like my evolutionary sort of genetics would kick in and my survival response would like trigger my mutation, and that would be that. I would, you know, put in my application. I had a whole process mapped out in my head for how it would go. I was training in the circus to like keep my other skills sharp. I was a pretty pragmatic kid. Mm-hmm. and so there was a point in time in elementary school where I started to realize, like, you know what? I can no longer guarantee that that's going to happen to me. I actually might be a normie. And so
heartbreaking.
I was like, crap, I should probably figure out like a paying job. So at that same time, I ended up watching an episode of Talk Sex with Sue, late night, you know, of course, as one does. And someone had called in, and sorry, for anyone who doesn't, get that reference. If anyone listening is familiar with Dr. Ruth, Sue Johansson is like the Canadian equivalent of Dr. Ruth. So had a late night show just exploring sex and would do things like listener questions and demos and all of that. And so this is my first exposure to this world, to this conversation at all, is this, you know, 60 something woman waving this bright blue double headed dildo on television. And she takes a listener question, and the person says, "Thank you so much for your work. You literally saved my life." And that was that for me. That was my application process. That was my welcome to the field ceremony. That right, it was the whole thing, right? That I wanted to, you know, be in the X-Men because I wanted to help people. I wanted to make a meaningful impact. You know, I wanted to be able to say that my presence on this planet was meaningful to people in a way that helped them be better in some way than they might have been before. And to hear that at that time, you know, someone could have said, "This sandwich changed my life," and maybe I, you know, would have opened a deli or something.
That would have been amazing.
But you know, it ended up, you know, really proving to me really early on that sex is a transformative part of our being, and who we are and as our sexual selves absolutely matters to how we exist in all of the other areas of our lives. And so coming to believe that really early on really shaped all of the rest of it for me. So I've never had a backup plan. I've never had any other things that I've been professionally interested in doing. And really, even the things I enjoy doing for fun really loop around this worldview that our relationships are integral to who we are. And so that's kind of how I live, and that's how I'm here.
That is magic. That is magic. Like, I love the clarity of just, yes, of course. This is how I save people's lives. So allow me to head in this direction. And then you made that happen. And like the beauty that has come out of that clarity is incredible.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we really connect with just a heart piece, mm-hmm. circumstantially, just walking through the world. And we have this moment where everything feels just so clear. It just feels like all of the noise is canceled out and we've just distilled on one important knowing. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those moments for me. And I don't actually happen to get those very often, being super middle childy and very much a Gemini, that I can argue every angle of every conversation by myself. So to have this moment of like perfect truth, perfect truth for me that resonated so deeply with who I want to be and how I see the world, was such a gift that I'm just so thankful for. I'm so thankful that I was, able to get that in a way that I recognized.
Yeah. I really appreciate too the clarity around one, sex is transformative and such a key aspect to ourselves and the way we move through the world, and how relationships, how relationships are integral to who we are. Because I find that culturally we devalue so many kinds of relationships. And I think that's one of the like big tragedies of kind of so many of the romantic narratives and fairy tale narratives that have come to pass over the past couple of generations, of just, you know, relationships of all kinds are integral to the human experience. And I know you and I have talked about like the power of community. And I wonder, like, what types of relationships do you experience in your life that really nourish and feed you?
Yeah. So for me personally, I'm currently engaged to my partner.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. So that's a relationship in which I've done a lot of growing, and coming to know in myself. And so if I ever needed sort of a personal proof that the relationships that we build and create in the world absolutely define and clarify who we are and who we hope to be, being in a long-term monogamous relationship certainly has highlighted how true that has been, you know, even in my own life. Mm. I'm also a pretty family oriented person. I'm like deeply in love with my family. I call my parents my babies. yeah, it's really uncool. But they're wonderful people. I have siblings that I adore, and I have a niece and nephew that I would love to, you know, be in deeper relationship with as they continue to get older. And, you know, those relationships are, for me, are so powerful. And I think that also I consider my relationship to myself as super integral. So I see my relationship with myself as a distinct relationship that I have to also schedule and make time for. I have to think about the ways in which I communicate with myself. I check in with myself. I want to know how my day is going. I want to know what I'd like for supper, like all of the ways that we would be tender and compassionate with other people. I'm really intentional about doing that with myself. I wish that we made more space to be really thinking about these different ways we connect to things. And it doesn't just have to be people. I have a relationship to, you know, the earth and the planet. Mm. you know, I have relationships with my work, right? I have a you know, really passionate, really just charged relationship, you know, to my work. Mm-hmm. You know, when other people talk about like erotic energy, I get that in the intellectual spaces of my life, right? That sort of intense, consuming, just oneness and connectivity. I get a lot of that also in my relationship to intellectual pursuits, which is why I work so much. It feels almost masturbatory. It feels really good to do things that you're passionate about, to do things that bring you pleasure.
Yeah.
And so those are the relationships that I tend to center. I do have beautiful, deep friendships that exist in my life. But as an introvert, sort of the space that those folks hold, you know, maybe are less centered, because mm-hmm. I just don't always have container or capacity to be pouring out of those spaces. But I think that, you know, as you were talking about community, I think often when folks come into my office, I see a lot of folks who, by all accounts, and they know themselves, are, you know, really well established, super connected, have great people around them, you know, have a professional trajectory that, air quotes, should make them feel really great and really centered, and, you know, all of whatever we're supposed to be working for, they've got it. But their relationships aren't fulfilling to them. And quite mm-hmm. often their relationship to self has taken such a major backseat to everything else that they have been creating, that oftentimes people feel like they've kind of been tricked, right? That like, I was supposed to build this, you know, whole life, and I did everything I was supposed to, and I don't feel good.
Yeah.
Right. All of this was supposed to make me feel whole and happy. And it doesn't feel like I thought it was going to feel. Sometimes people are saying it doesn't feel like anything, or even worse, sometimes people are saying I feel it all the time and it is excruciating.
Yeah.
And so I really do, again, continue to believe that, you know, we are creatures that are wired for connection, that, you know, as human beings, our first instinct is around survival, and the way we have come to code survival is through our community. And I want to know that other people have my back. I want to believe and be able to trust that the people who I have around me are also invested in my success, in my wellness, in my being. And when we feel unsure of that, when, you know, the context of life or the decisions that we make or that other people have made challenge that, it can be really, really hard.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was really interesting on a group call that I had recently was we were talking about how in a few weeks in our group call, we're going to be talking about boundaries and how boundaries are a collection of the things you do and that you don't want, your needs and wants, and how you articulate them, and the things that you, you know, won't tolerate or can't tolerate, and how it's a collection of invitations and rejections. And somebody on the call said one of the things they struggle with a lot is recognizing that their wants and their needs are valid, and that they can't force other people to give those things to them, mm-hmm. that they can't demand them of others, that they can't say, I expect you to do these things for me, that there has to be kind of this bizarre and space of like, I can say, these are my wants and needs, and the people around me can say, I can't give that to you, or I'm not ready to, or I don't have the spaciousness to do that right now. And then like, how do we tend to ourselves around that? And I think that's such an interesting question when you're talking about like relationship to self and relationship to community. I think that's a space that's really difficult for some people, because we hear so much like, you are inherently deserving of respect and of love and of pleasure, you know, that just comes with being human.
And to be in relationship with others is also to have some responsibility and some accountability in how you treat others and show up. And so for people who are kind of grappling with that of, I'm starting to recognize my wants and my needs, and I also have to navigate now other people and knowing, like, I can't demand these things from people. How do you think we can kind of dance with that ambiguity, that gray space, with a little bit more grace?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, folks are welcome to differ in their perspective of this, but when I talk about boundaries, when I help folks navigate their boundaries, the thing that I always end up saying really up front so that people are aware of how I'm going to be doing that work with them is that I really believe that your boundaries are really about you and for you. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it. That I know boundaries in a lot of ways are relational, but part of why they feel so vulnerable is because largely you're communicating about self. You really aren't saying very much about other people. And when you recognize that what you're doing is communicating about your sort of windows of tolerance, your own needs and requirements for you to have a safe experience, it's largely an invitation. And so, yeah, people can decline an invitation.
Yeah.
And that's going to have an impact on you. And so maybe that's a thing that you continue to negotiate, or maybe that means that the person doesn't get to play in your vulnerable spaces, right? Because sometimes what we're actually doing is giving folks access to more vulnerable parts of us, right? That I'm saying, okay, here is the way that you might be able to enter this space. Maybe that space is a romantic partnership. Maybe while you're in the romantic partnership, then you start to negotiate an invitation into a sexual partnership. Maybe in that sexual partnership, maybe you start to negotiate certain behaviors or practices, words, feelings, these escalating levels of invitation. And so I think that sometimes when we talk about boundaries, they sound like declarations or proclamations, or actually sometimes in my office, folks feel really reactive to setting boundaries because like, I don't want to give them an ultimatum.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, then don't. Right. Then don't give them an ultimatum. Can you give them an invitation? Right. Hey, if you'd like to come over, here is the information for how to do that. I'm going to give you the directions for how to get there. And if you don't follow the directions, you probably won't make it. Please RSVP if you're interested. Right? And so I think that as we think about how do we negotiate boundaries in ways that don't make it about if you don't do this, then you are blankety blank and you can't blank, blank, blank. Sometimes it's about shifting the story or the intent behind it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that sometimes will mean that people that you have invited don't come or won't come or can't come into that space at this point in time or really maybe ever. And to acknowledge that you're also interacting with other people's boundaries as you make an invitation.
Yeah.
That I could invite you to do something that doesn't actually feel safe or comfortable for you. And so I could say, Dawn, I would love for you to be really mean to me. Like, even if I tell you stop, I want you to be really mean to me. And if that doesn't feel safe or comfortable for you to do, then you're going to want to decline that invitation. Mm-hmm. And so even as I want to invite you into a space for myself, I also am acknowledging that you're on the other side of that negotiation with your needs and your wants and your possibilities. And so we have to, even as we make a request or an invitation, also be able to hold space for the other person's no, because that's the exact thing that we are asking in that space.
Yeah.
Right? If this is about, if boundary negotiations are still about consent, then even as I make a request of you, if you don't want to do it, then in some ways it doesn't get done.
Yeah.
And so we have to think about what we do with that. And sometimes even just the awareness of that process that, oh, as I make a request, this is still consent-based. Then I'm also still responsible for how I negotiate the rest of it for my own safety. So if that means if I say I'd like you to take off your shoes and you say I actually can't be in a space without my shoes on, and I have to say, you know what, then you can't come, but I was really in desperate need of someone to be over with me, you know, to be in my home with me, then yeah, it's really disappointing. And is there any other level of negotiation that can happen for me to be able to get what I need still?
Yeah.
Even if it might not be with this person or in this particular way.
I'm so glad you said that disappointment piece, because I think so often we're so terrified of sitting in disappointment or even witnessing others' disappointment that we kind of do these mental gymnastics of bending and ignoring our needs or our boundaries or other people's needs and other people's boundaries because we can't tolerate the discomfort of that disappointment. And like, to me, that disappointment is just part of being two or more human beings trying to navigate the complexities of all of our stories. And like, disappointment is inevitable. And so the more we can tend to self around those disappointments, I think the more likely we are to then be really clear in the ways that we ask for things and articulate things. But I think so many of us are so scared of the disappointment and the rejection, especially if we've been in a relationship where we feel like we're rejected a lot, that we start doing really, really kind of creative, but also very harmful often and toxic things because we're just trying to do anything we can to avoid that feeling.
Yeah. And I'm so compassionate to like the gravity of disappointment. Mm-hmm. So I consider all of our, you know, emotions as existing on like a spectrum of intensity. And so that's when we can get into some really awesome nuance around the difference between, for example, being like annoyed or frustrated versus like angry versus enraged, right? The difference between being surprised or unprepared or startled and being shocked or panicked, that I think that those are spectrums of intensity of feelings that have sort of a similar quality. And so when I think about disappointment, if we were to take disappointment in my mind and amplify it, the experience that you get is one that most of us, if you've ever experienced it, will actually spend most of your life organizing away from, which is depression. The way that I think about depression is not that it's about sadness. I think we often talk about depression and sad and use them interchangeably, but anyone who's been depressed can think about times when they were in their depression where they also recognized sadness and they didn't actually feel like the same feeling. But when I offer, you know, that depression is not intense sadness, but actually a 10 on our scale of disappointment, a lot of folks really resonate with that. A lot of folks can really say, wow, yeah, that is what that feels like. The experience of depression is about this overwhelming sense of disappointment in self, in future, in past, in possibility, in the planet, right? Wherever that sort of sits for people. So I'm really compassionate and tender with our, you know, avoidance or difficulty in navigating disappointment, because it feels so unsafe for anyone who's felt active depression, right? So not just periods of time at which you are depressed, but it really does. It's scary. It's a really scary place to be, to lose some of our, you know, almost for a lot of us, the hopefulness that we take for granted. And so, yeah, from that place, I absolutely get why it can then be really hard to negotiate boundaries when people on some level are thinking, like, I am putting myself at risk for this place where I might lose my sense of hopefulness in the possibilities for the future. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, the ways in which, you know, in the conversations that you have on this platform and so many, you know, other really powerful, just brilliant people are having it about how we can do boundary negotiations, how we can bring consent into other aspects of our lives, how we can, you know, navigate feelings like rejection, which threatens our sense of self, how we can do that more, because a lot of this is also about just skill. We were never taught how to do a lot of this stuff, but we're all somehow expected to just like turn 18 and here's a set of car keys and adulthood.
Yeah.
And right. And all of a sudden you're supposed to have all of these like really difficult skills.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh, like now you're supposed to understand not only how to file your own taxes, but how to uproot deep-seated shame in your life. Like, mm-hmm. you know, but we've had no experience with any of that before.
Yeah. God, that's so real. And I feel like so many of us stumble our way through experiences and mistakes and failures trying to figure these things out because we didn't have a chance to practice them before we reached adulthood, and we didn't have someone who helped us to navigate all the feelings around that. And I know something else that you talk about that like was a big just like yes for me and also for so many others was kind of in this a similar vein of like, we're not really given the tools to learn how to practice and feel our way through rejection and disappointment and frustration. And also there's kind of this like nebulousness around trust and like, what does it mean to trust someone? And what does it mean to lose trust in something and then want to rebuild it? And you have this wonderful formula for trust that I think it's one of those things where like, if someone, when I was really young, had given me this formula and then helped me to kind of examine different relationships in my life using this formula, it would have given me so much more context for so many of the feelings I was so confused about. So I would love it if you could tell everybody a little bit about your trust formula.
Yeah, I would love to. So, of course, by being a relationship therapist, trust is a thing that shows up as a major concern because, just like you said, once we lose trust, once trust is impacted, it can feel really hard to get it back because we also have no idea, one, where it went. Like, where does trust go when it's not here? You know, it's like, you know, that question, like, what do your toys do when you're not watching? Right. One of those existential crises that I used to have as a child. I'm like, are they playing without me? and so, like, where,
amazing.
Right? Where does it go? And then how do we get it back? Because we don't even really have a sense of how we built it in the first place. So when we're trying to work on it, like, what are we even working on? So my father is an engineer who's the sort of dad who, you know, if you wanted to get something from the store as a kid, you had to know how much it would cost after taxes. And this was before, of course, everyone had like a cell phone and could just like sneakily add it up. Like I had to do the mental math or else like, no, you cannot have that Kit Kat bar. So of course, as a kid who, you know, liked Kit Kat bars, I needed to be able to do some mental math around this. And so that put me in a position in the world where I sort of make formulas for things that don't require them because it helps me, it helps me understand them better. And so here is the formula that I came to around trust after working with all of these people, trying to help them create this experience. So trust equals transparency plus consistency over time. So I'll say that again. Trust equals transparency plus consistency over time. We all have heard things like, you know, time heals all wounds. Most of us can, you know, have experiences where we'll be like, that's crap. Because, you know, Cindy was mean to me in the second grade and that shit still impacts me now.
<That's> so real.
Right? You know, I will never wear, you know, stripes and polka dots together again because, you know. So, right, that there are things that happen to us when we're really young that still impact us, right? So one from my personal archives, I don't feel super safe around geese because a goose was particularly mean to me at the zoo one time. And so, no, goose, I do not trust you. I don't know you in particular, but I've had previous experiences that suggest to me, you don't want to be my friend. And it's been over 20 years and that hasn't gone away. So time by itself isn't going to cut it, right? Consistency matters because we track frequency data. So we need things to happen more often than not for us to learn the association between the two. Unless it's like really, really bad and then we only got to do it once, right? So you get bucked off a horse real bad and you don't need to happen that to happen like 9 different times for you to have some trepidation the next time you get back on. But some of the relationship science, this comes out of the Gottman Institute, some of the relationship science around what we need around consistency is like 5 to 1. So 5 positive experiences to outweigh 1 negative experience. So if you and I fight one day out of the week, but we have 5 good days, it was still a pretty okay week. But if we fought, you know, 4 days out of the week and, you know, nothing positive happened or positive things happened, but, you know, we still fought 3 times, it was probably a pretty crappy week. Yeah. Even though we still had 4 good days, it's just, it wasn't enough to outweigh, you know, all the times when we weren't getting along. So we need things and people to be consistent with us so that we have an opportunity to unlearn negative associations or attributions to them. And then transparency. I think that sometimes the piece around transparency is the thing that trips people up the most. And I'm really intentional about saying transparency rather than honesty. We tend to go to honesty whenever trust is broken because we think that that was the problem, right? That the person was dishonest. Mm-hmm. And it is part of the problem. But it ends up being this, you know, weird dilemma where honesty actually requires us to have some degree of trust, right? Yeah. That if I ask you a question, I actually have to trust you that you're going to give me an honest answer. And we've maybe all been in this situation where we feel like, oh, well, it doesn't matter what I say because you're not going to believe me anyways. And so that kind of highlights, okay, so trust, you know, honesty really isn't going to cut it when it comes to trust.
Yep.
So transparency is different in that transparency is this generous giving of truth. Honesty requires you to have either trust already built in the person or puts the person who's requiring truth in a really difficult position of having to know what to ask to be able to get truth from a person. They have to pursue mm-hmm. truth in order to get it. And so if trust has been broken, that also in some ways feels unfair on the part of the person who is now looking to rebuild trust in someone else again, that I actually am doing a lot of labor in order to get truth from you. The example I often use, you know, has to do with food, as most of my life does. Before this call, we were actually talking about French fries. So you can see how deeply my relationship to food goes. Right, so the example I often use is to demonstrate the difference between transparency and honesty goes like this. Honesty is the experience of you coming back to the table as we're, you know, sharing a meal, and you say, "Did you eat some of my fries?" I respond, "Yeah, I did." Transparency is you getting up from the table, and I'm saying, "You know what? As you leave, I'm probably going to eat some of your fries." or you coming back to the table and on your way back, I let you know, like, oh, just so you know, while you were gone, I helped you with your fries. Right? It's a very different relationship to information. That it's the difference between you coming, you know, two partners who live together who have maybe had a breach in trust, where one partner comes home and the other one says, where did you go after work? The other partner says, hey, I stopped off, you know, at the bar with some of my friends, and then I came straight home. As opposed to the person who was stopping off with their friends saying, you know, giving a call or a text message saying, hey, before I come home, I'm going to stop off at the bar with some of my friends and then I'm going to come straight home. Or as they enter the door, hey, I'm aware that I'm late. I stopped off at the bar and then I came straight home. Those are really different emotional experiences. With transparency, the person who is, you know, trying to rebuild trust in another person can sort of let go of some of that hypervigilance, right? Because when trust is broken, it hurts. It changes how we see the world. And so we, on some level, also want to protect ourselves from getting hurt again. Mm-hmm. And so they're allowed to do less of that defensiveness and less of that vigilance because they can put their faith in that anything that I am supposed to know will come to me rather than me having to go out and pursue it. Right, that things that are true will be given generously to me rather than me having to work to earn them.
Yes. I love the phrase of just like this generosity and giving that comes with the transparency of I am offering this to you. And if it's the kind of thing that doesn't matter to you, you don't want to know about, you can let me know. But if it does matter, here it is. And we can kind of figure out from this place of, here are my cards. And, you know, I have had that experience, as I'm sure many people have, of, I feel like I should be asking something, or I feel like something important isn't being shared with me. And I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's important and maybe it's not, but there's something that isn't being shared, right? The cell phone gets turned over when I walk in the room, or the laptop gets closed, or there's a topic that we're avoiding. And that creates so many questions and self-doubt, you know, like, is that really happening? Or am I being too sensitive? Is there, I don't know, I've asked and I'm not sure. And, you know, it starts this whole thing that's so tough to manage when you're like, I'm pretty sure there's something, but I don't know what the thing is, versus that offering of like, oh, hey, I was just texting with my sister. She shared something with me that's private, or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, and the not knowing is maddening.
Yeah.
And even if someone were to then respond with honesty, it feels different when you had to ask for it.
Yeah.
Because now we're not actually in that trust space anymore. In some ways, not that we've missed the opportunity for trust, but the thing that we're doing now isn't necessarily building trust. Or we have to work really hard to get back to that place. Hey, you turned your phone over. You know, who are you talking to? Oh, it's just my sister. So then why did you turn your phone over? Oh, because she said something private. Right? You see how that dynamic now sounds and feels very different than someone yes. comes in the room and you say, hey, my sister said something private. I just want to let you know I'm going to turn my phone over. Or, hey, I'm feeling compelled to turn my phone over because my sister and I are talking about this private thing that I don't want you to see.
Right.
Or maybe you do that negotiation ahead of time. I always encourage people to not try and solve problems while you're in the middle of crisis.
Oh my God. That's, yes, please.
Right. That's probably not right. You're not going to have access to like your best, you know, creative solutions while you're in the middle of like active just survival mode. So as much as possible, you know, when we have these moments where we notice like, that's a thing, for us to then start doing some strategy around if and or when that happens again. So we have agreements that we can be kind of living into, right? So, hey, what do I do when there is a private conversation that I don't want you to see, knowing that we have had breaches around trust with my use of the phone?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And being able to negotiate that. Well, nope, I always get to see your phone. And you say, you know, I hear you on that, and that feels challenging for me. I want to be able to show you my hands, and that feels like a place that is complicated because.
Yeah.
But we don't live in a culture that encourages us to be transparent. You know, even if we think about, like, regular things like negotiating your salary, you're supposed to, like, you know, how much money did you make at your previous job? Right. You're supposed to say, like, you know, 20% more than you did. Mm-hmm. Right. Or, like, how far are you away from the restaurant?
Right. I'm around the corner.
I'm on my way. I'm around the corner. But truthfully, you're like 6 corners away from being around that particular corner.
Yep.
You know, or even dating advice. I've heard all kinds of just wild dating advice, as I'm sure you have. And, you know, I end up being in contact with a lot of Gen Z folks who have a very different dating landscape than most of the rest of us, just by virtue of how integrated to the technological world that they've kind of always been. As a millennial, we had early fluency, but Gen Z have never known a time that wasn't digital.
Yeah.
You know, so I got Facebook, I think, in, you know, I guess I was at the start of high school, maybe. Although I was certainly too young to be using Facebook, but, you know, you lie on your profile and you make a page, right, as one does. And my brother was in, like, the second or third grade by the time he started lying about his age on the internet, which is, like, a rite of passage. It's just a thing that you do to get access to stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an entirely different world. And it feels so interesting to me to hear the way they talk about the way you communicate with other people, given that most of it is online. You get to do a lot of things that don't require much transparency. And so how terrifying, or even just, like, inappropriate it feels for them to be truly transparent, like what it means to leave someone on read, even though you've certainly seen their message and are, like, kind of dying to respond, but won't.
Yep.
Because of whatever the, you know, reason in particular is, or you downplay how you feel about something, or you amplify how you feel about something. Just all of the ways that we mask and perform our real experiences to make them more palatable to other people, or to try and perform these roles that we feel like we're supposed to live into or live up to. Most often live up to, because we live in a society that has framed it such that we are not good enough as is, which is why we're expected to work hard. Right? I no longer believe in... I personally don't... I do hard work, yes, but I don't believe that working hard gets you any closer to any desirable outcome. Mm-hmm. Right? So my challenge to myself has been to try easier rather than to try harder. Because in my personal life, I have heard try harder used, you know, to indicate that the reason why you're not getting the outcome that you want is because you have been insufficient.
Yes.
And I just, I really resist that. I really resist that as a way of being. This idea that you have to hustle in order to, you know, make a living. You know, the idea that you have to earn it, right? That you get rest when you have earned it. We need rest. We need pleasure. We need leisure as much as anything else, right? We just did the Explore More Summit, you know, chat. And, you know, I'm so glad that you centered it around play. We need play. But people will have a reaction to you playing if they don't feel like you've done all your work.
Mm-hmm.
But play is developmental.
Right? Yes.
Play is a way that we can heal and come back from trauma. Play is a way we connect to our inner self and our inner world. Play is a way for us to access creativity. So for us to not play, we're robbing ourselves of a really important human experience.
And I think like play is such a key to getting unstuck.
Absolutely.
You know, like, I mean, I think the vast majority of the listener questions I get, and I'd love to, if you're up for it, do at least one listener question before we wrap up. But, you know, I think relationship stuckness is pretty chronic in the types of emails that I get. And often when I get these questions from people, there is such a lack of play and creativity. It's, we've been doing this same thing for 19 years or for 7 years or for a year, and it's not getting better and it's not getting easier. And we're just kind of like digging our heels in. And I think that play and that creativity is one of the most profound ways for us to just completely shift a perspective and to like, okay, maybe I don't have to focus on the stuck places. Maybe I can focus on the easy places for a while, and then new things will be revealed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, a thing I'll just add quickly, sort of to link, you know, the two pieces of conversation that we just had, was that when folks are not feeling very trusting, it really shuts down their willingness to engage in play. And when we think about sort of the origins of our relationships, the point in time at which we started to trust one another, a lot of that was manifested in our playfulness with one another.
Yes.
And so it's a way that we can, you know, really come back to the authenticity and the origins of our relationships, right? This idea that we are deserving of levity and play, and that transparency is necessary for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. So important. And I know, like, I know people have feelings, right, about being transparent because it requires vulnerability and taking a risk. But the payoff to both transparency and to play, I think, is tremendous.
Absolutely.
So I would love, you just said this thing about like, when we're new in relationships, there's like all this play. And one of the questions that I wanted to go over with you is from someone named Lost Lonnie. And they talk a little bit about how amazing things were at the beginning of their relationship and how now they're feeling very different. So if you're up for it, I'd love to read the question for everyone and then to explore it a little bit with you.
Yeah.
Okay. So Lost Lonnie wrote in, and it's, the subject line is cheating as a fetish or non-committed. Hey, Dawn. First off, I want to say I love the podcast. I've been binge listening to all of them. I learned so much these past couple of weeks. So my problem is I've been with my partner for 4 years. I love her so much. She's the love of my life. When we first got together, the sex was amazing. But this past year, my sex drive for her has gone down so much. I never want to have sex with her. I'm just not sexually attracted to her anymore, but really mentally attracted. In my past relationships and situationships, I've been the other woman. We've tried having her cheat, but now I don't want it because boundaries were crossed. On the other side, I want to cheat. I masturbate almost daily thinking about a girl I used to sleep with that had a boyfriend. We've also tried different things like kink or penetration, and I'm not into it. I just seem to only be super turned on by cheating. I don't know if the cheating thing is me not wanting to fully commit or something that's okay that it turns me on. Please help, Dawn. I don't want to do anything dumb because we're not having sex. Lost Lonnie. So I would love to know what you think about Lonnie's situation.
Yeah. So as a typical therapist, of course, my first, you know, my brain first goes to questions rather than answers. You know, I always am really fascinated or interested in getting to know people's definitions for things. Mm. So there's a point in time where Lonnie said, we tried her cheating and it didn't help. You know, talking about cheating, I'm mostly interested in cheating. I've been the other woman. And so I'm really thinking about or hoping to understand more about what Lonnie is describing or defining as cheating. Is it about
the other person not knowing about these external relationships? Is it about connecting with people outside of the relationship? I would love, you know, for Lonnie to think a little bit about what that means for them, mm-hmm. and how they're defining that word. And so that's where my brain goes first. I also think about, is this something that, you know, they were thinking about before sex stopped being a thing that they were having or wanting to have with each other? Because I think sometimes that makes the difference between, oh, we're doing this to solve a relationship issue, mm-hmm. versus, oh, this is, you know, my actual fetish or a thing I'm actually into on a bigger scale, right? Yeah. This might be, on the one hand, right, that could be true, right? This is just something that I'm into. This is a way I prefer to exist in the world. This feels good to me. This feels safe to me. This feels comfortable to me. And if I were to do some work around destigmatizing what that means, maybe there's a way for me to do that healthily and respectfully. Mm-hmm. Or on the other hand, it could be, I have reached this impasse in my relationship, and the only way I have known how to negotiate this space before was to experience folks in less consensual ways, either by being the other woman where, okay, I'm in a consenting relationship with one person, but they are, you know, breaking boundaries on their relationship. Or I don't know if this is true for Lonnie, but for them to be, you know, breaking consent boundaries on their relationship and being sort of the affair person rather than the affair partner.
Yeah, I love your questions around, what do you mean by cheating? Like, what specifically are the behaviors, the feelings, the actions that are coming up there? Like, is it the risk? Is it the fact that it is lying and taboo, and so the stakes are really high? Like, what is it specifically that you mean by that and that you are fantasizing about and getting off on? And I really love your question of, was this something that you wanted before your feelings about the sex changed? Because I think you're so right. Like, if you had this kind of agreement and experience of, here's how the relationship's going to be, and then now your feelings about how sexually attracted you are to your partner have shifted, and now you're trying to find like band-aids for the solution, for the situation, or trying to mm-hmm. kind of just find any way to not feel that kind of stuckness, and this seems to be the way you're doing it, I think it's a really important thing to note. I also think and that there's a lot. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I would love to hear the rest of your thoughts. I just got excited about an idea and then.
Oh, yeah. Tell me the idea.
No, I was just thinking about. So I'm sort of a believer that most things can be negotiated. And it doesn't mean like you just keep pressing the issue until the other person, you know, assents or dissents. But I think oftentimes we're so afraid to have the conversation that we lose the possibility to negotiate. Mm-hmm. And so I would love if they could consider exploring, okay, what would make this possible in our relationship? Because it sounds like a big part of Lonnie wants to stay in the relationship that they currently have, and that the sex piece is feeling challenging. And so it sounds like they've tried a number of things that were not cheating. But if cheating is sort of the thing, how close can we get to that? With both people feeling safe. Mm-hmm. Could it be about flirtationships? Could it be about, okay, let's role play. And so you be this whole other person that I don't really know, and we'll meet in some, you know, different place, and, you know, we'll talk about your partner and whatever, you know, cheating looks like or feels like. But how could we introduce some degree of play and creativity into figuring out, okay, if cheating is really the thing that is taking up a lot of space in my, you know, sexual desire, and I want to figure this out, what can we negotiate for?
I really like that creative approach of I definitely love you and I want to stay and I want us to find a way to make this work. So what are the creative approaches that might open us up to new possibilities and new feelings? I love that so much. I'm also wondering, just for like Lonnie to kind of sit with it, I'll never forget there was a period of time several years ago where I was having an affair with a married man. And our time together was perfection, like absolute perfection. Mm. And after a few months of that, you know, we had kind of started reaching a point where it was having an impact on his marriage. And we had always said, you know, if there starts to be an impact on your marriage, you'll, of course, you know, we'll end things and you work on your marriage. And, but the reality of that moment when that choice had to get made was horrible. And my therapist at the time said, the two of you are in love with the fantasy of each other, but you don't actually have the lived experience of being around each other when you're not in this fantasy world. You only ever meet up at hotels. You only ever meet up when you're like frenzied. You only ever meet up when it's been super planned and had all this build up. So of course, every single minute together is explosive and charged and exciting because the stakes are super high and you don't have to deal with any of the nose blowing or the socks or the anything else that comes with sharing space in a very real way with another human being. And that always just kind of like really made an impact on me because, you know, I've certainly had clients in my practice too, who as soon as the deeper kind of uglier vulnerability of being in relationship with another flawed human being really sets in and that NRE, that new relationship energy, starts to shift, there's this, oh shit, things are about to start feeling different. And I'm scared of that. So I'm going to do what I can to get out of that situation, either because I don't want to be seen that way or because I can't tolerate seeing others that way. And so I'm going to either end the relationship or do something super destructive to make the other person end it so that I can then move into something that feels new and exciting all over again. Yeah. And so I also think just kind of like asking yourself, you know, like, what is your tolerance for what it might mean to be in a sexual relationship or not with someone with whom you share a life with, where there's going to be stress and responsibility and the challenge, the very real and sometimes delicious challenge of talking about who's going to make dinner and who's going to make the dishes and who's, or wash the dishes and who's going to do the laundry and who's going to scrub the toilets and when the bills get paid and how do we nurture this erotic energy for each other amidst all that?
Yeah. You know, passion over time is often something that we have to be kind of working at right in the beginning. It gets to, for a lot of folks, be really sort of, you know, spontaneous and self, you know, manifesting. And then over time, we often have to be doing things to continue to have that relationship energy present. And so people who have passionate relationships over time are still doing things to continue to have that be. And so that's a thing for Lonnie to be thinking about, you know, as she processes those questions, you know, that you were asking, right? That have you maybe exhausted that sort of early relationship energy where the passion takes care of itself? Maybe there are things that could be done or could be revisited that might bring that back. Mm-hmm. And also maybe it's run its course, right? I want to acknowledge that as a very real possibility as well, right? That sometimes we've sort of done the thing and that could be very real. Maybe there's part of Lonnie that knows that maybe part of Lonnie really is done with the sexual piece of their relationship. And so what might that mean?
Absolutely. And I love that permission because, you know, one of the, I think it was Bex Caputo who said this around, like, they were talking to their therapist about whether or not they wanted to go on testosterone. And they were kind of saying, like, I don't hate my body and I'm not miserable you know, in this gender and, or not the gender, but just kind of like being in this body as it is right now. And their therapist was like, but why do you have to be miserable in order to make the decision? Mm. Why can't it just be, I like things the way they are, and I might like them even better if I do this other thing? You know, like, we don't have to wait till we're miserable to make a change. And so I love this permission you're offering, Lonnie, of like, we can still deeply love someone and deeply care for someone and recognize maybe this isn't the version of the relationship that I want to stay in anymore. You know, I don't have to wait till I hate you and I don't want to be with you in order to start transitioning the relationship into something else. It might hurt a lot, but that doesn't mean that's not the right decision. Sometimes stuff just hurts. And so I really appreciate that you offered that permission slip too.
Of course.
So Lonnie, thank you so much for writing in. I hope this gives you lots of things to think about. I'm all thinking now. And Shadeen, I just want to thank you so much for joining us this week for all of your, I really want people to sit with your trust formula and kind of the difference between honesty and transparency. I have a feeling I'm going to get a flood of emails with questions now from people who are like, oh my God. So for people who want to stay in touch with you, how can they find you online and kind of follow along with your adventures?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter at my name, so at Shadeen Francis. You can also find me on my website, ShadeenFrancis.com, and those two places are where I tend to post kind of where I am and what I'm up to, and if folks have further questions or would kind of like more on any of these topics, those would definitely be great places to reach out to me at.
Thank you so much for being here, Shadeen. I cannot wait to hear how people are thinking and feeling about all the things that we discussed. And I love your brain and the way you think about things. So thank you for bringing your wisdom.
Oh, thank you so much for letting me have these conversations with you.
To everybody who listened, be sure you head to sexgetsreal.com where you can, of course, write in with your questions, your comments, your stories. Also, you can get all the links for Shadeen in the show notes as well as at sexgetsreal.com. And don't forget, if you're a Patreon supporter, we're going to have a bonus chat. So pop over to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to get your weekly yummy bonus conversation. And until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah. Bye.